Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Oh, this is my quiet. Everyone ever in the group has been like, hey, good to see you. Lunch was that bad? How you doing? My name is Chris Jackson. I'm the worldwide lead for enterprise application compatibility and modernization. It's kind of what I do for a living. And as part of that, I end up picking up a whole lot of Windows internals knowledge because you kind of have to. You know, I'm kind of going after a bunch of grungy old applications, typically written somewhere between the 90s and the mid-2000s, and trying to sort out what's wrong with them on top of every possible technology. And a lot of the compatibility issues also really come out of the security changes that are happening. And what we're trying to do this time, we had a session on Pass the Hash yesterday and a session today on Emmet, is kind of take some of this internals viewpoint. How does Windows work? What are we doing to help protect you, to kind of give you some insight? Because I was looking through, and I really love Emmet. I guess I'll start off with, how many of you have heard of it and are familiar with what it is? How many of you are using it today in production? And how many of you really have any sense of what it does? Because that's kind of what I saw was, we'll tell you how to configure the darn thing, but we don't tell you what it is. And it seemed to me a glaring gap. So what I'm going to try to do, and I've got 60 minutes to do it, is I'm going to try to walk you through what exactly this thing is so that you have some sense of, hey, here's how I can make a rational, reasonable argument with my nerds about why it's important. Fair enough? All right, and for those who don't, I hope to also acclimate you, get you familiar, and show you what this thing is. Now, before we get started, it's a long way away for me to get to New Zealand, and so in order to get there, I had to have a sponsor, and given that I learned from Google you should always do it through advertising, we're going to go ahead and start our session with a little word from our sponsors. Volume up.
Years and years ago, in 2005, Computer used to look like this. Back when I was 1 year old. Look at this thing! It weighs way more than me! Like Windows 8, my surface looks this small! And it is so much more powerful! And it also features Android integrity control. That's one of UAC for all your non-hackers out there. It keeps me safe when people try to hack me. And that my credit card number is stolen 5 times! I wouldn't have a credit card! Now I'm protected by application isolation. It keeps me safe when I run my Windows 8 apps.
Those are lots of bad happening.
Aha! Someone's trying to hack me.
I'm a genius hacker. Okay. I'm a hacky good player. Own it.
Windows 8. It is made of pure awesome sauce.
Yankee, awesome sauce. I want you to pack my good player.
So Windows 8, our sponsor for the event. Back to the regular scheduled program. Let's talk a little bit about what Emmet is. Incidentally, I, for a while, was pronouncing it Emmet, and I got struck down by the cybersecurity nerds. Like, it is not Emmet, it is Emmet. And I'm like, you just made that up. You can't correct me because you happen to choose a pronunciation of an acronym differently, but that's what the cyber guys call it. Emmet is really a way to help protect your system against vulnerabilities that haven't been detected yet, right? And turns out it works. So when we look at some of the vulnerabilities that have come out against the browser, against Office, and against Adobe, all of which are protected by default, by having Emmet enabled, these are the security vulnerabilities that didn't impact you, right? And that's always the story that matters. When I think about all of the things you could do to keep yourself secure, it doesn't really matter all of the things you can imagine happening. And in my line of work, I run into a lot of people with really deep imaginations who can imagine these incredible horror stories with a likelihood of close to or potentially equal to zero. What I care about is the stuff that actually happens. Base your reactions upon the real world. And the real world is telling us, hey, we can get some protection really quickly before the vulnerability even happens. Now, what it isn't, it's not antivirus, right? What we're trying to do is go after weaknesses in the system that we know how to defend against in the code, in the language, in the implementation, in the compiler, that we're aware of to get it those opportunities for exploits out of the system. It really is all about helping to protect you against how attackers are attacking today. And as a result, guess what that means? You get on the Emmett train, you gotta stay on the train, right? Emmett 1 isn't doing much good for you today. Keeping up to date and always on the latest with Emmett, much like the applications that you're running behind it, ends up being really important. So how Emmett works, it leverages the app compat framework. Shocking. Wow, how did I know about that? Oh, that's right, because I'm the app compat guy. And what we do is we intercept and analyze API calls to implement all this functionality, and we're going to go mitigation by mitigation and talk about what these things are. But first of all, let's really understand how shims work. How many of you are even aware of what a shim is? So a handful of you. How many of you deeply understand how they are implemented in the operating system? Okay, let's fix that. So this, incidentally, is a hardcore talk, I'm told. Is that right? This one's a hardcore one. So it's something we're premiering this time, and so I, of course, brought some hardcore guitar picks that I'll kind of... Wow, that made it all the way there. I am an awesome thrower. I'm like that guy at the event, so we'll get some swag. Yeah, I feel like Nikki Six now. throw them around if you got too many or don't want any. So we're going to go deep on purpose, because this is all about how do we deeply understand this. If anything goes completely, that's okay. We're going to come back. We're going to take you on a series of waves. We're going to end up in a debugger sometimes looking at assembly language, but I really want to make sure that whatever level you're at, you can end up a little bit deeper at the end of this, right? That's what I'm going to be trying to do this entire time. So shims, we think about what shims are. It really boils down to the way that Windows itself works in order to tie together functionality, the concept of the DLL. Because from the perspective of an application, Windows isn't Windows and GUI and blah, blah, blah. Windows is a series of DLLs that you can leverage to do work on your behalf. That's what it does. And how that gets implemented is they have to get linked together. That's a useful readout. Here we go. Let me zoom that back out and take a look here. We have a series of DLLs that we can leverage the functionality, right? So kernel 32 implements functionality like, you know, opening and reading and writing files. User 32 is the graphics APIs and things like that. All of these implement in DLLs that I import. But here's the problem if I'm doing a pure import. DLLs might have to move around. In fact, let's go in and take a look at this application I'm using right now. PE Browse Professional. Let's go find this guy. Oh, it's hiding on me. There we go. I just know this happens to have one. Let's add a column for the image base address and then the base address. So the image base address is, hey, this is where the application asked for the image to be placed. And then the base is where it ended up. And the challenge that comes up is you may have asked to be in exactly the same place as somebody else. Here's an example. Oh, no, those actually are different. Oh, that's awesome. Let me see if I can quickly spot one. Let me see if I can quickly change the colors, options, configure colors, and take my relocated DLLs and highlight them. It's going to be fantastic if no. Oh, there we go. There's one right there. So this one in the image base asked for something and it had to be moved. It had to be moved because it couldn't fit, right? Because a DLL specifies, hey, put me at this place in memory. I'll have all of these things hard-coded that tell me where to go so that my jumps all happen really quickly. You may have to move it. That's called rebasing. And so as a result of that rebasing, we put in a level of abstraction which says, no, don't just jump to this address in memory because you might have been moved. Jump to the address pointed to in this table. That's called the import address table. So this table here, you can see, this is a tool called PE Browse Professional. It's free because I'm cheap. That lets you visualize exactly what's going on inside a Windows file. And this will show you the address table. When you load the program into memory, what happens is we take that address table, we have the offset. Here's where each of these functions lives. And we add that to where the DLL base address is. And now you've got a table. Jump to the address pointed to by this entry in the table, and that's where your application ends up living. So far, so good? We're grungy, I know. But right, this is fundamental to how we're able to change behavior. Because now we have a table. What do I need to do if I want to change the functionality? Go into that table and put it someplace else. So let's take a look at that. Let me actually go into the debugger. Because, hey, you know, it's a hardcore session, so I think we're required by law to do that, if I'm not mistaken. We're going to go into a simple application called the version checker. And in the version checker, let me go ahead and make this font an awful lot bigger than that so you stand a slight chance of being able to actually read it. Maybe bring it up to 20. That better? Right, that's the size. That's about what you guys normally look at for debugging stuff, I assume. And let's do a breakpoint on version checker bang main. And we'll pull in those functions, and we'll go ahead to the main function. The debugger's going to pull up the source code. I don't care about the source code. I want to look at the unassembled function. So UF is the debugger command that says, take this function and show it to me in assembly language, because who doesn't want to look at functions in assembly language, right? Reason why I want to is I want to show you how this gets implemented in the assembly language. Here's how we call a Windows function. Call dword pointer, the pointer that sits here. So we jump basically through. Call the function at wherever this address in the table jumps to. This lets us dereference that and figure out exactly what this is. So if I look at this function and I say, show me the symbol near that, the nearest symbol, and it's going to show me right at that address. This address in memory points to kernel 32, bang, get version EXA stub. Detail of implementation. But it's pointing to actual kernel 32. Now let's shim it. So we'll go into the compatibility administrator tool, which is a tool that we distribute to help fix broken applications. It's a tool that you can leverage for getting things fixed. And in this case, we're going to go in and apply a version lie change. So we'll just do, for a demo, by me. And users is sitting on my desktop. Cjax desktop version checker.exe. And go in and do a, I don't know, WinXP SP3 version lie. I mean, who knows what else we want to do. This isn't a class on how to fix up busted apps. I'm just going to fix up everything called this. I'm not going to leave this around, so it's fine to be really vague with it. We'll save it. We'll call it demo. We'll stick it on the desktop and call it demo because we're lazy. At least I am. I don't know about you. We'll install it, and now we're going to restart the application because shims are applied when you start the application. And we'll breakpoint on version check bang main again. And let's take a look now at what we're pointing to. And, oh, that's awesome. We'll watch what's happening. I've got to download the symbols, because you'll notice I am not looking in kernel 32 anymore. I'm looking in something called AC layers. What we did is we replaced that address that was pointing at kernel 32 with the address in a separate DLL called AC layers, stands for application compatibility layers. Swap it out, put new functionality. And it turns out that's exactly what we do to implement our emmet functionality, right? Here, now we have the function. WinXPSP3:li, API hook, get version EXA. So we swap out the functionality. So, that's the detail. So what we do with emmet is we're taking, in many cases, mitigations that are provided by the operating system, but we don't do them by default. Now, why do you think we don't do them by default? Yeah, because of my job, right? Because all your apps would break. If they didn't break, we'd turn them all on by default. But there are lots of things that are not compatible, right? So when we talk about, for example, data execution prevention, right? We'll get into the details of exactly how that's implemented, but it turns out there's a lot of code that breaks. For example, every single version of Java up through about 1.3 didn't mark all of its generated assembly language as executable code when it generated it. So you'd break all of your old versions of Java. Most of you would say, thank goodness. But that's why they're not on by default, which is why you as the administrator need to balance and not just turn on everything and say, now we're a lot more secure, except everything falls over. And believe it or not, we've seen that happen, where people just turn everything on and then notice, wow, that's not really a good thing, is it? In fact, that's kind of a horrible thing. So let's walk through and talk about what each of these things are and how they might be able to help. So we'll kind of go in order through all these different mitigations. One of them is address space layout randomization. Most of what we are protecting against with all of these emmet mitigations is about people taking an explicit knowledge of memory and how the system works in order to leverage it. And the attacker's ultimate goal is to be able to run whatever code they want, right? Runs code of the attacker's choice is the ultimate fail for you, because now they own that device in whatever context they're running in. The higher the context is, the worse off you are. And so they're leveraging their knowledge of memory. So one thing that they will often do is they will often go in and take their knowledge of where DLLs are and jack some code into that spot of memory. Take advantage of the fact they know where it is. In fact, a lot of times an attacker will go, there's some code right in here, which if I got that code to run, would actually do the nefarious thing that I want to based upon the current layout of the stack, if I could just jump to it. I don't even have to write the code. The code exists. I just have to jump to it. And if it's always at the same place in memory, right? Remember, back to our example before. Let me unzoom this guy. There we go. Remember back to our example before, we were looking at Process Explorer. If the base address is always where it lives, then that is a problem. I don't want it to always be in the same place. I want it to potentially move around so the bad guys don't know where it is. So we have this thing called address space layout randomization that we added back in Windows Vista, which of course everyone deployed, right? As soon as it came out, it was like the world's most successful operating system next to Windows ME. There really was good stuff in it, right? We'll just not talk about that. We'll agree to not talk about that. But a really powerful technology that allows us to move things around every single time. So if you plan to jump someplace, the next time you reboot, it'll be gone. But it is applied DLL by DLL. So if I start looking through each of these, there is an entry in every single one that says whether or not it supports address space layout randomization. And some of them don't. They're not aware of it. They've never been tested, so you don't know if they're going to work, right? So first things first, if I'm thinking about just throwing it on, it might make sense for me to look into Process Explorer and say, well, is everything already opted in? In which case, why? Goodness, turn it on for everything. It can't possibly hurt it because they're already taking it. The more DLLs you move around, the more protected you are, as you might imagine, because now you're taking away an attacker's explicit knowledge of memory, being able to help them, because that address is going to change time and time and time again. Now, about that address and getting to where code runs, it's probably worthwhile. Oh, I stopped debugging? Oy. No, apparently not. Where's my... command window. There it is. It just disappeared on me for some reason. I must have clicked X by accident. Here's another phenomenon that many people don't understand about how Windows. How many of you actually do assembly language stuff and kind of remember it from college, which is where anyone ever did stuff, right? How we determine where to go next. We have a pointer called ESP, the stack pointer. This is in 32-bit, 64-bit's a little bit different. There's a series of registers which are extremely fast memory access, and wherever ESP points to, that's the instruction that's going next. So if you can get control of ESP, you control where the code's going to execute next. Well, how do you get control of ESP? Because when you exit a function, you hit the ret thing, we just pop it off the stack, and we pull off the last function you're going to right off the stack. So if you can write on the stack, you can modify ESP the next time a function returns. So that's why we don't want people to be able to point to places they know. If it points to someplace random, then all of a sudden random things starts happening, and it may be irritating, but you don't get to run the code of the attacker's choice. You get to run the code of randomness's choice, which seldom does interesting things. And there are a bunch of ways that that can be potentially exploited by partially overriding it, since we only have some bits that are partially randomized. There are other things that we can do in terms of relocating things. When we have things that are opted in, we can just opt the rest in, use the mitigation. So the ASLR mitigation turns on ASLR for everything in the process. Moves things around, so if you get control of ESP, planning on jumping into another known DLL, that's going to move, because you're writing it into another unknown function. Okay? Mitigation number one. The next one, ASLR incidentally is probably one of the most powerful mitigations that we have, probably tied for effectiveness with data execution prevention. It's been around longer, so the bad guys don't rely on it quite as much. But it's still very, very useful. Data execution prevention, right? When we think about running code of the attacker's choice, I'm trying to get a hold of that ESP pointer and point it someplace else. And if I point it someplace else that has some code that I wrote directly, that's a really fast and easy way to get it done. In fact, let's dissect one of those. So here's a little function that's leveraging some old school C-style code, right? Any C developers out there? Couple? Yeah. Everyone's like, yeah, God, a long time ago. Who writes C anymore? Turns out most of what we do is pretty unsafe. So the string copy function, or str, CPY, how it works is we take the input function, the input buffer, the output buffer, and we start copying character by character. And we don't stop until we run into a null character on the input, regardless of how big. So if I, in this case, size the output to 8 characters, there's no guarantee that we're going to stop after 8. We don't know how big the buffer is. It's just an address in memory. So we just keep going until the input hits an end. So what if someone gives us this input? A lot more than 8 characters. All of a sudden, they're giving us input of A, and then they put in the address of some code they like to go and run. So now let's take a look at what this means to what's happening in memory. So the A in memory starts at my SC out. So if you look at the stack, that's the bit of memory. SC out pulls in the first 8 A's. That's what we allocated for it. But we haven't hit our null character yet. So we keep going. And we write on top of the next variable, the J variable, which is an integer, 32 bits. So we keep writing our A's. The ASCII value for A is 65. Then we still have more, no null character. So we keep writing. We write right on top of the base pointer. And then we still have more input, and that input is specifically crafted to be the address of where I'd like to jump to, which is the return address, which gets immediately lopped into the ESP variable when we call that ret function to pop out of that function. Now the attacker is running code wherever they want to. And if you put the malicious code directly on there, instead of putting in A's, you put in assembly language instructions, you can point it to that space on the stack, now you're directly running code of the attacker's choice, and your own. So what does DEP do to stop that? Well, in every single call to allocate memory, eventually, by the way, this is the Bing experience in the US. It's a whole lot nicer than the Bing experience in New Zealand, just so you know. Very informative. So here's virtual alloc. And virtual alloc takes as parameters whether or not you should be able to read or write or execute the code. Right? Virtual perfect and all this, right? All of this comes to how do we allocate this memory. So when you're allocating, you're saying, is this read-only? Is it read-write? Or is it executable? If you don't mark it as executable, and you try to put the stack pointer there on every single processor that you can buy today, there's hardware support for this. It will immediately trigger the processor to go, stop, cannot be done, because this is not marked as executable. It's built into the hardware. It's fast. It's efficient. We could simulate it without it, but the simulation wasn't nearly as good. So now we stop it. In this case, I'm on the stack if I'm writing my code directly. Is the stack allocated as executable code? No. Stack pointer goes there. Immediately it blows up, and it fails. In fact, we can even see an example of that. I can show an example of an attack that you used to be able to do really successfully back in the old days, and just inject whatever code you want to. Here's my code. So I created this buffer as the input into my function, and I'm just going to go ahead and copy it in there and then bounce right over to it, and that would cause me to immediately start executing it. That memory is sitting on the stack. As soon as the instruction pointer goes to it, immediate access violation triggered by the hardware, it interrupts processing, and the attack doesn't proceed. Now, your app crashes, so it's not exactly not inconvenient, but it doesn't work. So that's data execution prevention. We can turn that on. Now, as I said, if you have the sort of application that generates code on purpose, that can be bad, because the generated code, if they don't mark it as executable, will then cause your app to crash as soon as it goes to run it. But most modern software that tends to do that will be okay. So again, as with all of these mitigations, test it. If it works, carry on. As an example of some of the things that we have done with this, one vulnerable framework, one that doesn't work, the ActiveX template library, or ATL, for versions 2003 and earlier, they're not compatible with DEP because they will dynamically generate code and then execute it. Now, we get around that. So one of the things we had to do is we had to build an all-new Windows API in order to support that. So the API is, look at that. First hit. That's awesome. I don't think I even looked for that before. Set process depth policy, which was added for Windows 7, if I'm not mistaken. I think we may have backported. We can actually look at the bottom. For those of you who don't look at the API implementations, the documentation will tell you when we have it. So we added it for Vista SP1 and then backported it and also put it in XP, SP3 and above. And it's also on Server 2008 as well. And this gives you three options for how to turn it on for the process. Turn it off, turn it on, or turn it on with ATL Funk emulation, which allows us to work around ATL's slight problem. Because the ActiveX template library, guess what people build with that? ActiveX controls, hence the name. What's a really dangerous process? What's something that goes to the furthest reaches of the intertubes and has access to all kinds of bad guys? Flash? Well, the web browser. in which Flash runs, in which ATL runs, in which everything else runs, right? So you've got probably your most vulnerable process hosting controls that if you turn on dep, break it. So therefore, since everything is inside of the iExplorer.exe process, because that's how ActiveX works, you can't turn on this mitigation. So we added this API that says, turn on this mitigation and automatically fix up the ATL bits, which is what it does. It lets us turn on DEP by default for the browser and work around the ATL issue, which keeps us a whole lot safer on the web. So that's dep. Next mitigation, the next thing we're protecting, right? We're going all through memory, which is why we keep diving into how the Windows memory systems work, is SEHOP, right? Or Structured Exception Handling Override Protection. So Structured Exception Handling. Structured Exception Handling baked into Windows, and the fundamental idea is here's a systematic way in which we can handle exceptions. So you run into something that happens in your code, we'll immediately start calling the exception handlers. But here's the thing, you can chain them together. You can potentially have multiple exception handlers that you'll want to get called together. So as soon as something bad happens, okay, where's my exception handling chain, and start iterating down through them to see who all wants to be notified that something bad happened. Right? Baked into Windows, it's been there since probably V1, and it's a process by which things happen. Now, a lot of developers today try to specifically avoid structured exception handling, not because of the security aspect, but because structured exception handling, on average, takes about 3,000 CPU cycles just to get started. It's an expensive way of handling an error. But nonetheless, it's baked in, and it can be leveraged. So if you do something to trigger an exception, now we're going to start rolling through this list of function pointers to find functions to call and execute those exception handlers. So if you're a bad guy, what do? You get yourself on that list, pointing to whatever bad guy code you want to run. Now you're in the memory as well, and you're executing new code just by triggering an exception. And if you're impatient, you then trigger an exception to get your code to run after that, if you could possibly do that. Kind of nefarious. So how do we protect against that? Well, we have the ability to, in essence, put an end of the line to the chain and modify the behavior of structured exception handling that will validate, before we run through the whole exception handling process, that we actually get to the end of the line. So if I'm able to overwrite something and add a new address, but the new address doesn't eventually point to the end of the line of the chain that is defined and known, which unless I know a lot about the specific chain that's implemented right there, I can't do, then I don't reach my final validation frame, it triggers an error, and we're able to stop it, because we have extra code running inside of there. So we can now start to protect and ensure, before we run that whole chain, does the chain go to the end? If the chain doesn't go to the end, suspect someone has put something in the middle, and don't run any of it, protecting us from the attacker running the code of their choice. So far, so good? Anyone's brain melting so far? Is this too deep, too high level? Is this too? I actually thought about actually putting in real attacks, but then I'm like, I don't really want to talk to LCA that badly, because that triggers lots of conversations like that. Let's move on down the line and look at the next protection, which is heap spray protection, right? Still, we're in memory. What does an attacker do? They can go in and spray random code in the middle of the heap that ends up being something they can influence in terms of data or code, and they just know where things are getting picked up. Now, this is the first of what we call pseudo-mitigations. Right? There are two things that we can do. There's a mitigation. This actively protects against a whole class of activities. And there's pseudo-mitigations, where we just protect against what we've actually seen. Still very valuable, but the pseudo-mitigations are the ones you want to keep up to date. So if we know that people are using a buffer overflow, which happens too much still, I'll go with it happens too much, more information on the heap that can be used at some point later on in known locations, we, at the very beginning, will just allocate that bit of memory. So when they try to put that something there, we're already there. So if they're trying to spray their bad code, as one example, let's say they got a bit of memory on the heap that is marked as executable, and they'll use a buffer overflow to get their code on there first, we come in at the very beginning and we pre-allocate it. So that when they go to jump there, they're jumping in the middle of our code, which probably doesn't do anything nefarious and doesn't help them. So basically, we get there first. And similarly, with a null page, and this is another pseudo-mitigation, right? If you dereference a null pointer, there are some theoretical ways, we don't know of any actual ways to do it today, where you could actually have something truly there. And if you get called in a way that avoids access violations and things like that, you could potentially get something there and have something nefarious happen. So what we do is we ensure that that doesn't happen in this case. It's very similar to what we do for the heap spray protection. What about export address filtering? So here is something else that's based upon the way that Windows happens to work. Let's go ahead and dig back into a Windows binary this time and kind of show you something a little bit about the way that Windows itself works. So let's go into C, Windows, syswow, because I'm running a 32-bit debugger because I'm lazy. Actually, I'm not even a debugger. I'm in a, yeah, let's do kernel 32. Or, I don't know, yeah, that one's fine. We'll load that up, right? Because the way that Windows works and the way it's designed to allow you to put in what your exports are and then to modify the behavior that happens. The reason why is to support hot patching. This is conveniently going to take a really long time to load, which is awesome. I love it when that happens because I'm very patient. But what we have is a function prelude, and we'll show it to you in a moment. For every single function, we have a prelude, a few instructions, specifically chosen to be instructions that open really quickly. Just not in PE Browse. So I'm going to try opening another one. And of course, that's not going to open another one. That's awesome. So let me force open another one. And try it again. And grab, what's a good one? User 32. There we go. That one's a lot faster. So here are the exports. We have a list of all of the functions that get exported. And if we look into how they're implemented, this is at the entrance to every single Windows API call, right? Move EDI, EDI. So it moves, so assembly language deciphering, for those of you who aren't assembly language aficionados, move instruction, as you might guess, says move the contents from this memory address to this memory address. So we are literally moving the contents of the EDI register into the EDI register, which is a no-op, basically. Does nothing. So why do we happen to choose that one instead of doing a no-op? Because it's the fastest way to do a no-op big enough to allow us to put a short jump. So at the beginning of every little bit, every function, there is blank memory above it that can host a long jump. So we can now, in that line of function, just directly replace the code with a short jump to the space above it, and then do a long jump to wherever else in memory we need to go. It allows us to hot patch. So when you get your Windows updates, you can immediately start running the new code. Then when you reboot, the hot patch goes away, and then you can start doing things the right way. Now, we haven't eliminated reboots, but that's part of the reboot reduction approach. So prelude, every single one, move EDI, EDI. You can patch that. And in fact, there's commercial software out there that we sell from Microsoft Research. It's called Detours. That just goes through and patches that up for you. And the bad guys also know this. And in fact, you can go and find the code to do this in Jeffrey Richter's book, which used to be Advanced Windows, and now it's Windows via C/C++. Christophe Nassar, who's from Microsoft, he's in France. helped to bring it back to life because it's so useful. The source code for how to do that is freely available. It's not freely, you gotta buy the book, but you can go buy the book and do it right off there. It used to be chapter 6, and now it's, I think, chapter 12, or who knows, but it's really easy to do. So the bad guys do that too. So how do we protect against that? Well, we start intercepting the export address table. We start monitoring what's being put in there so that if we see if someone's putting in there, we can gauge that memory address and ensure that our stuff hasn't been moved. Basically, we put ourselves in between there. We go into the export address table as well. Bottom-up randomization. So if I allocate a new bit of memory, again, the bad guy's knowledge of memory is their power. If it lands in the same spot every time, now they know where they could potentially put their nefarious code. So what do? You put it in random spots. So we have to intercept the heap APIs and add some entropy so that the memory allocations don't show up in the same spot every time, taking away the attacker's knowledge of how your memory is laid out. And return-oriented programming. So as we get more sophisticated, so do the bad guys. So the bad guys have figured out just spraying code onto the stack, spraying code onto the heap, that's a path that keeps getting blocked on them. So what do they do, right? They're smart. They figure out, here's some code that's really useful in a bit of memory that already is there. It's part of a DLL. I'm just going to call it, but I'm going to call it out of order or with different arguments. But I'm just going to leverage the code so I don't have to do that. So what we can do to help protect against that is things like intercept the load library API. So load library is how you do dynamic loading of a DLL. So if we go back here to how we implement this, someone has a default ringtone. That is so boring. See, this morning I had an awesome ringtone on that was like a rock and roll one. I was jamming. But the whole doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, I mean, come on. If you're going to have your phone on, get a much more awesome ringtone. So, import table. These are DLLs that we know at compile time. We're going to use these, guaranteed. They're already baked in. But dynamic link library, this is statically linked. We know we're going to use them. Dynamic linking means I can use them whenever I want to. So you have to have an API to do that. So we have load library. Load library followed by get proc address. So go open this DLL and then find the address of this procedure in the DLL based upon its export address table. So what do the bad guys do? If they are able to own load library, they load their own DLL. And instead of having the load library come from your hard drive, they'll just go ahead and pull it from the internet or from the network and go and get it that way. So what we do in the ROP protections, we'll do things like, hey, let's look at the argument every single time you call load library. If it's a UNC path, don't let it through and block it straight away. All of these ways that they can go through and double check, right, if they're trying to change the memory protection on the stack. So they figured out, hey, you don't allow us to execute this code. If I can get a smaller bit of code that allows me to set the executable properties for my larger bit of nasty code, then I can run it that way. So we look at that and make sure, is this is not on the stack, is this is not someplace where it could be nefarious, and protect against it that way. We also get into the web business. As I said, the browser is a great source of evil. There's lots of things going on that are pretty nasty. So what we can do is help protect man-in-the-middle attacks by going through and ensuring that the certificate for a site isn't just any trusted certificate, but is a certificate you expect to find on that site. Otherwise, what can happen? If you can get admin rights and install a certificate into the trusted store, then suddenly you can man-in-the-middle your way through and intercept all kinds of potential information that goes somewhere else. So we can have a managed list of known good places to go. attack surface reduction, right? So we had a session this morning about the browser, and we talked about one of the things that we're doing in the world of IE is we're going to try and block when you're not in your own internal zone. So we exclude by default the local intranet zone and the trusted site zone. But other than that, all of your old versions of Java and the big bad internet will not work anymore. And this is systematically a problem, is if you have this installed in your system, it's a property of COM and ActiveX, which is built on top of COM, that will just will load it up anytime anyone asks for it. What attack surface reduction allows us to do is say, don't load Java ever in this process. So someone can't find a way to instantiate via a document a vulnerable Java library and then exploit it. You say, you know what, just don't load Java for me at all. Don't load Flash for me at all, because HR makes us run the crusty old version of Flash, which actually happens a lot. So we can specify which zones they work in. And finally, we take this export address filtering a step further in the latest version, version 5, and we start to look at specific known attacks against specific known DLLs and start to protect them. Places like kernel base, kernel 32, NTDLL, things that are known to happen, and look to do explicit additional protection to protect their import address table and their export address table, to mark that memory, make sure people can't write to it at all in order to protect against those kind of mitigations. So let's actually take a look. We're pretty far into the session here, and we still haven't even seen what Emmet looks like. So the GUI for it, let's take a look here. I have a lot of windows open. Get this guy out of the way. And I've got it running in the tray, so we'll go ahead and open it. And it's going to elevate to run it. And then take a nice long time to open up, which is always awesome. And this is the user interface that we get. So one thing, thank goodness they did, they allow it to be skinnable, right? This is super, super awesome, right? Because now I can make it Emmet style. And boy, that's a whole lot better. I'm glad we spent some dev cycles on that, because that was just absolute crap before, and now it's awesome. So here's the interface that we get. So when we look at what we're able to provide, we can turn off DEP for the entire system, which you can do via some really buried control panel entry. You can do via group policy, but this lets you do it directly through the UI. And there's also a group policy for Emmet that you can distribute. So when you get the agent, you set the policy, and everyone's going to pick it up. So this isn't just an end user who's particularly nerdy, wants to protect themselves. This GUI lets me define it, and then I can manage it, right? And there's a whole manageability story. The manageability story, there's actually sessions already on that one. So I'm not repeating those. I wanted to do the guts of it, because that's what I couldn't find any information on. So we can turn on DEP for everything. We can turn on structured exception handler overwrite protection for everything system-wide. I have ASLR on system-wide and certificate trust enabled everywhere. Let's take a look at some of the details. So let's go into an application, and I'm going to add an application that's a demo app. It's called Emmet Test, and it was one that was written that specifically does some naughty stuff, and we're going to try and protect it. So we'll go ahead and add the application to the apps list. So here's the apps list. I'm going to add a new one. And I'm going to pull this off of my desktop. And here's Emmet Test. And by default, it'll let you pick which mitigations do I want to put on there. Because like I said, the reason why we don't just blanket do this for everything is that it breaks apps. So it's going to start off with the ones that tend to be the what you want the most. You can add more protections if you want to. I'll go ahead and just take all of them. So now I have every single protection enabled. Actually make sure there's nothing else off to the side. Yep, and now I've got them all done. So now, let's go in and run it. Right, an Emmet Test is a test application, just says, here's all the naughty things I can do, right? It's like the bad guy toolkit. So I'll do Emmett test, and of course it does two hyphens, which is awesome. And includes the word test because that's not, I guess, explicit enough with the Emmett test. That can mean a type. Test heap spray, and it's going to... Oh, that's awesome. That didn't work. That would be awesome if I didn't save my settings. Let's go in. No, I didn't. Aha! Look at that. See, it doesn't protect when you don't turn it on. So now you can see that it actually did something naughty and didn't get fixed. So let's enable everything. Let's say OK. And let me make sure it still shows up. Does that show up there? Emmett test. Yep, look at that. All right, so turns out the OK button is a good button to click. Let's try it again. Oh, and now Emmett detected. Here's a problem, and we're going to go ahead and close up the application. Bad guys are there. Again, we haven't sort of kept the application running seamlessly. We've crashed the app. But which is worse, crashing your app or letting the bad guy run the code of their choice, right? And that's what we do. And then we let you submit it, right? So I'll go ahead and not bother to send them information that the test application the team actually wrote was something that didn't work. Let's do... ROP test not implemented. That is sweet. Thanks for putting that in the options, guys. So let's do Emmett test, and we'll do test EAF. And there we go. We detected this mitigation, and we're going to close the application. Right. So now every time these bad things happen, when someone's trying to leverage one of these mitigations, we shut it down. What about on the website? On the website, I can go in and look at my certificate trust. So here I am defining all of these websites, and I have these rules, right? So here, by default, I get things for Facebook and Office 365 and Skype and Twitter and all this, and I can specify, hey, these are the keys that I expect to find there, and if you use another one, we're going to tell you something's amiss. And I can make it a blocking rule, so I won't let you get past it. And if I make it a blocking rule, let's go ahead and go to Twitter. And every time I go to Twitter, when I'm on a stage, someone who has a Twitter on their phone Twitter bombs me, which is always fantastic. So we'll go to Twitter, and here we are. Oh, look, there's Nigel, clearly not in my session, so we had to kind of question Nigel's sanity. Because he didn't come here, so what's wrong with this guy? So here's Twitter, and everything's okay. Now let's build a man-in-the-middle attack. I'm going to use a tool called Fiddler. Fiddler allows me to intercept secure conversations and decrypt that traffic so I can see what's happening. And it does this by having me add a certificate and trust it so that suddenly Twitter is itself the man-in-the-middle. So now I have a man in the middle. And, oh, look what just happened. Since it's actually polling live, there's a problem. And now I can't get there. Is there any other browser other than IE? if it's not using our TCP/IP stack, then I don't know if we actually went through it to use something else. Most browsers actually will use us under the covers for doing that, the platform features, rather than implementing it themselves, because it's really boring code that doesn't add value. The browser part's what adds value. We can test it out, though. We'll test it with the major ones. Let it not be said. Let's go see what the experience is like. Well, I didn't do anything interesting for me there. And again, there's nothing like proving it for yourself. Sure, that sounds fine. We'll restart it. So it let me get through on Chrome. So don't use Chrome. It's terrifying and dangerous. And, oh, but it's okay to use Firefox. Yeah, so that's your determination. And again, I literally just tried that for the first time ever. I don't know any additional details beyond that. But you can see that we actually do catch that in Firefox. We didn't catch it in Chrome. I don't know why. The details of implementation of theirs, which are kind of dynamic, I don't know. But yes, definitely protects you on IE, which is the most common corporate standard. Although I'm seeing more and more people deploying Chrome as a side-by-side. There are very few people who can do Chrome only. So they always have the IE as part of that. But it really depends on what you're trying to protect and where what people will use to get there. So definitely part of that. So with that, I have like just a couple of minutes left. I'll go ahead and kind of summarize where we are. Let me actually, you know what? I hate all this related session stuff. I'm from Microsoft, in case you forgot. But let's kind of rewind and re-talk about what this is. The number one greatest attack vector that we're seeing is people manipulating memory and leveraging their knowledge of the layout of memory to get in and run the code that they want. That doesn't mean that you can avoid protecting against the weakest link in the human-computer interaction, which is usually not the computer. It's usually the human. So there's still that human part of it. However, you can protect against things happening leveraging these tools. You can turn them on. So from an action point perspective, I strongly recommend getting the latest version, which is Emmet 5. It came out about a month and a half ago or so, and trying it out. Pilot it on your system. Start adding it to additional applications. It's going to, by default, protect stuff that we know pretty well works. It's going to come on automatically, fixing up and helping to protect you when you are running apps like Adobe Acrobat, apps like Microsoft Office, apps like Flash and Java, all out of the box. So it's immediately going to start to reduce attack surface area, and you can start to expand that. As always, you're going to take a very risk-driven approach. What are my most vulnerable workstations? Let me focus on those. What are my most vulnerable apps? Where are people trying to get me? It's all based upon being sensible. But leveraging this as part of a comprehensive strategy, because, as mentioned earlier on, this stuff actually works to... this does not have a touchscreen. Whoever designed a conference with no touchscreens, with all this great practice we have in doing touch, mystifies me. The stuff actually works. It really does help to protect you. It's worth a go. It's taking all of these memory protection technologies in Windows and helping to make your experience more secure and protect against the attacks that people are actually using today on ever-changing landscapes. So with that, my name is Chris Jackson. Please submit an eval. Hope you have a terrific end of Tech Ready, and I hope I was nerdy enough for you.